You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
G'day, Annie McLaughlin here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, workers' stories and social justice issues. This program is produced in Melbourne for 3CR and broadcast across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. In today's program, we look at two stories which are the two faces of the same coin. We report on the March for Australia rallies on the 31st of August. We follow this with part of a presentation by Isa Camarillo from the US about her report, Exporting Instability, Importing Exploitation, the impacts of US trade policy on migration in Latin America. As we witness the seeping of the Trumpist right-wing racist narrative onto our streets, or as Isa says, as Trump and other politicians use immigration as a political weapon, the real crisis goes unexamined. The economic system that displaces people through trade and investment policies exploits their labour upon arrival and criminalises their existence. It is worth our while to see what our compatriots in working America are contending with. Sunday, 31st of August, shockingly, saw a neo-Nazi taking the main stage in front of Victorian Parliament at the head of the March for Australia. National Socialist Network member Thomas Sewell spoke on the steps of Parliament House in Melbourne CBD at the March for Australia rally. He was caught on camera savagely kicking a woman at Camp Sovereignty as 20 or so neo-Nazis attacked the Indigenous encampment in King's Domain later in the day. As Jordan Vanderkamp says in Red Flag, as he tracked the beginnings of the far-right rallies that occurred in most of the major cities and some smaller rural areas of Australia on Sunday, calling for the end of mass migration, the March for Australia isn't some wishy-washy far-right populist event patched together by suburban mums and dads with legitimate concerns. It has been initiated and built with direct neo-Nazi involvement every step of the way. How did this rally of about 2,000 in Melbourne, 10,000 in Sydney, several thousand in Adelaide, hundreds in Brisbane, and you have to love Broome, where one lonely Australian flag holder was cheered by a happy crowd across the road with placards saying everyone is welcome here. How did it happen? Jordan Vanderlam meticulously outlines how a 3rd of August video by Sam Bramford calling for a rally against mass migration was posted to TikTok and Instagram. The post quickly gained traction, reaching hundreds of thousands of views in a few days. According to a subsequent public X Spaces stream with one of the nationwide organisers of the rally who goes by the name of Beck Freedom, the video's virality prompted certain unnamed individuals to reach out to Sam and to put him in touch with her. Since then, Sam has relinquished any involvement in the rallies and responsibility for organising them has passed to people described in the stream as trusted individuals within the far-right movement. Vanderlam goes on, even on the more outwardly respectable public-facing level, the veneer has sometimes slipped. In the X Spaces stream mentioned earlier, Beck Freedom, the main public face of the rallies on a national level, stated that the march is to protect white culture, heritage and way of life. In a previous X Space stream, she also said that we need to see violence, like what happened in the 2005 Cunnulla riot. This argument wasn't met with disgust or apprehension, but by her co-host saying it didn't go far enough. As political commentator Van Banden wrote at the end of the day in response to apparent shock of some of the ordinary Australians, in inverted commas, at the rallies, who were putting forward a legitimate opinion against immigration, that Nazis turned up to their rally. She said, "If any of the shocked are reading this, say these words out slowly, repeat until you understand them. Nazis didn't turn up to your rally, you turned up to the Nazi rally." The numbers that turned up against mass migration coincidentally appear to be similar numbers seen at the anti-vax rallies during COVID. The whole affair should be put into perspective. The 20,000 who rallied across the entire Australia are completely overshadowed by the counter-rallies of anti-racist, anti-fascists on the day, and the 300,000 people who walked over the Sydney Harbour Bridge recently in support of Palestine. The belief that migration is the cause of the housing and cost of living crisis is so easily debunked by facts that this propaganda is both insidious and venal. As Martin Barker from Red Flag puts it, the Nazis and far-right racists, including the son of one of Australia's largest property developers who called the reactionary march for Australia on the 31st of August, are demanding an end to mass migration because, in inverted commas, Australians are sleeping on the streets. He goes on to point out, first, there is no shortage of houses in Australia. As the Australian Institute think tank reported in March, the construction of new dwellings has outpaced population growth for the last 10 years. Indeed, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, the number of residential properties in Australia exceeds the number of households by almost 1 million. Second, there is no meaningful connection between immigration levels and rents. As TikTok user ADU has pointed out, the proportion of housing relative to the population in 2014 was roughly the same as today, but rent price growth in 2014 was 1.2% compared to 8.1% in 2023. Similarly, the Tenants Union in New South Wales has created a dashboard comparing rental price changes to population changes, which shows that there isn't a strong link between the two. For example, rent prices in the Sydney suburb of Ryde fell by 5% in 2019 and rose by more than 7% on 2022, but 33% more migrants moved into Ryde in 2019 compared to 2023. Dennis Evans, former Secretary of the Federated Confectioners Association of Australia and a 3CR broadcaster on Left After Breakfast, put out a post saying, "The most disturbing element of the march was the placards with photo of police murderer Desi Freeman held up to the crowd. If it was a Hamas flag flying at a demo, it would be condemned by the Zionists as anti-Semitic and call to ban such marches or a call for permits. So the anti-immigration movement now supports openly police murderers and Nazis. You can only shake your head," he said. And of course, it is interesting that the Zionist Social Cohesion Commissioner, Gillian Siegel, is missing in action. Not a word has been said about these marches. The whole affair should be put into perspective. The 20,000 who rallied across the entire Australia are completely overshadowed by the counter-rallies of anti-racist, anti-fascists on the day and the 300,000 people who walked over the Sydney Harbour Bridge recently in support of Palestine. We finished this report with the statement put out by Indigenous leader Robbie Thorpe after the neo-Nazi attack on Camp Sovereignty in Naam, which he designated as a terrorist attack. Go to his program 3CR Backblocks on livestream for further words. The so-called Take Australia Back protests were nothing more than a parade of ignorance dressed up as patriotism. To chant Australia for the white man is not just racist, it's delusional. How do you take back a country that was never yours? For over 60,000 years, this land has been home to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. White Australia is the newcomer on the world stage, and yet it clings to a fantasy of ownership, so flimsy it collapses under its own irony. The attack on camp sovereignty was cowardly and vile, an act of weakness pretending to be strength, because racism is never about pride. It is always about fear. Fear of difference, fear of equality, fear of being exposed as ordinary. It thrives on insecurity, feeds on ignorance, and masks its fragility with loud chants and empty symbols. Racism is not a show of dominance, it is a confession of weakness. This is why racism will never define a nation. It cannot build, it cannot create, it cannot sustain. It only divides and diminishes. No person is above anyone else, no matter how many times they repeat the lie. And to every migrant, every worker, every family who has built this country with respect, sacrifice and love, you are the living proof of what Australia truly is. Diverse, resilient and human. You build what racists only want to destroy. You're listening to Stick Together with Annie. We are now moving from the streets of Australia to the recent Trade Justice briefing on a report called Exporting Instability, Importing Exploitation, the impacts of US trade policy on migration in Latin America. As some people said, in Australia, the focus on migrants as the cause of the Australian workers' ills of a housing crisis, high prices and low wages in relation to the March for Australia was straight from the US. This briefing uncovers the corporate fingerprints on the US federal government's war on immigrants. First, we hear from Hilary Hayden, Organising Director of Trade Justice Education Fund, followed by report author Isa Camarillo, ending with Labor lawyer Joanne Trujillo from CHILA, Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles.
Today, we're going to be looking at the connections between trade policy and migration. Big employers move factories abroad to take advantage of labor rights violations, lax pollution controls, low wages, and in all those instances, hundreds if not thousands of people can be put out of work in just a single community, with ripple effects being felt right throughout that entire community. People with enough savings often move out of town in search of jobs elsewhere, but folks without the savings needed to chase that better employment, and often disproportionately Black and Latino households, but certainly not only Black and Latino households, are often forced to take lower paying jobs. This puts a downward pressure on wages and benefits for the jobs that are left. And then there's less and less money in that community to support small businesses, restaurants, hair salons, car dealerships, and all of those start closing up shop, right? And in the worst instances, property values start declining. The loss of tax revenues from all these different income streams, income taxes and business taxes and property taxes, cuts into the money that's available in a community for public services. This might mean that there's more kids in each classroom at school. It might mean that infrastructure or maintenance programs get put off, and it might mean that governments start looking into privatization of public services. This is the story of places like Flint, Michigan, and other cities throughout the so-called Rust Belt. But we've also seen it in Maine and in California and in the Pacific Northwest and in the South and in rural communities throughout the Heartland. This story is really familiar for folks across the Heartland and across the country. The economic damage and displacement that's caused by these trade deals has hurt working people all over the United States, but it's also hurt communities in Mexico and in Central America and elsewhere as well. When the North American Free Trade Agreement, that's NAFTA, was first proposed, its backers claimed that it was going to benefit working people in the United States and in Mexico. That argument was basically that NAFTA was going to open up Mexico to foreign investment, was going to provide new jobs for Mexican workers, and that by raising living standards in Mexico, it was going to create this new market, right, for U.S. exports. The Clinton administration claimed that by improving Mexican living standards, immigration from Mexico was going to be reduced by 2/3 within 6 years under NAFTA. The reality of NAFTA, of course, was far different than the picture that was painted by the Clinton administration. Working people in the United States have had to deal with the job loss and wage suppression, among other ripple effects that I just described, as roughly a million good-paying jobs were converted into maquiladora wage jobs south of the border. In Mexico, by the year 2000, the poverty rate had increased to over half the population, and the extreme poverty rate had increased to nearly a third of the population. Real wages for most Mexicans dropped, and the migration rate skyrocketed. So why did that happen? If a million new jobs have gone to Mexico under NAFTA, how is it true that most Mexicans suffered under that pact? One of the biggest reasons, among others, is that both the original NAFTA deal and the rebranded USMCA deal from President Trump's first term forced Mexico to reduce tariffs and other barriers to agricultural products from the United States, resulting in a flood of subsidized corn, wheat, and soy pouring into the country for less than what it cost American farmers to grow it. Small Mexican farmers saw the price that they received for their crops plummet as a result, and huge numbers, estimates are in the millions, have been forced off their land to look for work in cities, in borderlands, and in many instances to risk their lives crossing the border looking for work in the United States. Meanwhile, politicians like Donald Trump and many others vilify these migrants. They scapegoat immigrants for all kinds of problems that the migrants themselves had no role in creating, and this basically just distracts people from holding corporations and political elites accountable in any way for these clear policy choices. Instead, they increase ICE raids, they build detention facilities, they stoke hatred and fear in our communities, and they rip families apart. They make working people's lives harder and more precarious than they need to be. To talk to us about this in more detail, we're lucky today to be joined by our good friend Isa Camarillo, the Research Director at Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
Well, thank you, everybody. So this report came about because the two trending topics, immigration or trade, these are not issues that exist in silos the way that Washington likes to tell us that they are, and these are actually very, very much interconnected. And so the first thing that we did was develop what is the political narrative and what are the actual realities. On the news, we hear that migration is a border crisis and that it is, you know, it's criminals coming from the South and that they are invading, they're taking our jobs, they're driving down the wages. And as such, politicians, including Donald Trump, have taken these really harsh enforcement mechanisms. However, the reality shows that there's a historical reason for migration from Latin America, and that has a lot to do with regional trade agreements such as NAFTA, CAFTA, the USMCA now, as well as the US interventions that have taken place in the region. And so the report really takes a step back. We really zoom out and say, well, let's take a look. What was happening in Central America in the 80s? And if your mind goes to the coups and the civil wars, you'd be right. And the US influence from that era was pervasive, and that has led to all of the free trade agreements that we have now. There was also pressure from the IMF and the World Bank. And so all of these things have had lasting consequences. And let's not forget that for many Latin American countries, it was around that time that they were also gaining their independence from the Spanish crown. These were newly formed nations that, you know, all of a sudden were being thrust into trade agreements and foreign investment and things like that. What we're seeing now is just the consequences from that new form of colonization that came through trade agreements and economic policy. And then the other thing is that migrants are scapegoated to deflect the blame. And it's a very, very real blame that should really be placed in Washington and for the corporations that lobby in Washington for these trade agreements to be passed. The other truth that we can't ignore is just how much the United States depends on migrant labor. And so we talk about a dual exploitation, right? The exploitation that takes place when corporations go to Latin America to extract. And then also the migrants who are displaced and have to come to the United States looking for a better life or just survival in general. And then they come here and they enter as exploitable labor. We saw, as Hillary mentioned, the agricultural impacts were just really devastating. And this is coming from a region in Mexico that was already heavily dependent on agricultural labor. And so to have US subsidies come in was really monumental and very, very negative for the small farmers who lost their livelihoods. And then as a result, as a very, very clear and direct result, we saw the migration from Mexico double and then go up even further. And in certain regions, that rural poverty rose sharply. And the three states that we have there, Oaxaca, Chiapas, and Guerrero, are actually states where we have the highest concentration of immigrants in the United States from. So it's really, really no coincidence. CAFTA, starting in the 2000s, also had pretty much the exact same situation. And it was more of this race to the bottom that we see. There were really very weak or no labor or environmental protections. And so corporations were just chasing the lowest wages and the weakest rule of law. And as a result, we saw undocumented migration that rose sharply to the United States. I mean, Honduras, 122%. And then they had a lot of garment jobs that were really promised to absorb, well, really to strengthen communities. But then what happened was that when China came into the WTO, those same corporations very, very quickly moved on. I mean, without any sustainable development and investment in the region, they were able to just abandon and then set up shop very, very quickly, leaving a ton of people displaced. And then one of the most concerning findings is that Central America is home to a vast population of indigenous peoples. And so they were impacted possibly even more from CAFTA and the fallout there. Migrants are exploited here as well. And so they're pushed into this low wage, high risk number of sectors, so particularly agriculture, meatpacking, construction, service work, etc. And then their deportability and status in the United States is used to suppress wages, the block union organizing, and maintain worker compliance through fear. And I think what's important to really highlight here is that the U.S. economy depends on this vulnerability. This is very much a feature of the system. It is not a flaw. Corporations know this, and they lobby for this, and they profit vastly from this. The report is really peppered with testimonies. This is one from an agricultural migrant in Pennsylvania. They pick mushrooms, and they make roughly $4 an hour. And so I'll read their testimony. It says, "I came here to work. They know that. That's why they hire us. But the moment you speak up about pay, about injuries, they remind you that you're replaceable. At my last job, I was maimed by an agricultural machine and couldn't work for 3 weeks. They told me if I went to the hospital or told anyone what happened, they would call ICE and deport my family. They didn't pay me. I didn't complain, but they still fired me." Also, from the report launch event, we were really, really lucky to have CHIRLA participate. It's the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights. And we had the Director of Workers' Rights and Labor Legal Services, Yu Nguyen, and she was able to talk to us a little bit about what her clients go through.
So as many of you know, in Los Angeles County and beyond in Southern California, we have been dealing with the militarization of immigration enforcement, where masked unidentified agents are racially profiling and unconstitutionally arresting workers who have been living in the U.S. for 30 or 40 years. And so many of you might ask yourselves, why didn't you get papers during that time, right? So for almost 40 years, we have not had any meaningful immigration reform. In January of 2023, recently, the Biden administration had created a program called the Deferred Action for Labor Enforcement, also known as DALE. What it did, similar to a U visa, is that if a worker was the victim of labor abuse, which could be wage theft, discrimination, or retaliation, they could be granted protection from deportation because, similar to a U visa, they're witnesses in the labor investigation. But it was not required that they actually be witnesses, but that was the general idea. Now, fast forward to today, the program still exists in paper, but it is practically non-existent because a lot of the applications, the great majority, have been stalled since January of 2025. Other clients of mine worked in the poultry industry. They were displaced workers. They were displaced by trade policies in their home country, came to the U.S. to work in the poultry industry, where they suffered similar abuses. In the poultry industry, we also saw Guatemalan children as young as 14 years old who didn't speak English or Spanish, being forced to work up to 60 hours per week, child labor, using sharp tools in a high-risk job. So as you can tell, the ballot program had a lot of potential because, in case you didn't know, wage theft is the highest form of theft in our country. And nationally, about 17% of low-wage workers suffer wage theft. But in LA County, that number goes up to 88%. And the number is much higher because we have a high concentration of displaced immigrant workers who often don't know that employment law protects them as well, regardless of status. And we have an entire economic system taking advantage of that. So what does this mean for workers and trade policy? In California, foreign-born workers make up 1/3 of the state's total workforce. In other areas, the percentage is higher. So this shift in immigration policy enforcement is no coincidence. It is not just about racism. It is designed to weaken workers' rights and dissent at home. Because when you weaken immigrant rights, you weaken workers' rights. By silencing immigrant workers through worker dissent, through fear, through surveillance, through violence, through threats of deportation, and weakening due process for immigrants, this administration is serving corporate interests at home, many of those same corporate interests that it has been serving abroad. The current attack on immigrants, it is not just about racism, it's about weakening workers' rights at home. And when trade policies prioritize corporate profits, the only way to bring jobs back, as this administration claims it wants to do, is by undermining labor protections at home so corporations can continue reaping record profits at the expense of workers. And we must not allow that to happen. Both domestic and international policies must include strong worker protections and high labor standards, as well as immigration protections. This is an issue that concerns all of us. I always tell people I spoke with, go and look in your closet today. The clothes that you're wearing, they might have been made in Honduras or Mexico or Jordan or other countries by exploited hands. And if you take pride in buying clothes made in America, there's an 83% chance that those garments were made in Los Angeles by the same displaced immigrant workers who are being targeted today.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.